Red Ice Radio. This is an independent, intrepid, investigative radio program dedicated to dispelling the mythmakers and highlighting and exposing the insanity of our times, with a somber warning of the dangers that comes with building our world on the lies that we've been fed without venerating the spirit of truth. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. Our website is redicecreations.com, and you can find a lot more on a lot of different topics that we want to know more and learn more about. David Eberhard is a Swedish psychologist, writer, and debater. He was a physician at the psychiatric emergency room at Sankt Görans, one of Sweden's oldest hospitals. At the moment, he holds the same position at the psychiatry department at Danderyds Hospital in Stockholm. He is the author of four books penned in Swedish: How the Children Took Power, Normal, From Madness to Everyday Psychosis, also Nobody Takes Shit in the Land of the Easily Offended, and In the Land of the Security Junkies. We are going to begin to talk about the last book mentioned first, about Sweden's obsession with security and what kind of issues this have created over the many years that these policies have been practiced. Depression, anxiety, and many other psychological issues have been on a sharp increase in Sweden since we came into the new millennium. We'll proceed to talk about the many psychological issues that have arisen among Sweden's population due to the child-rearing policies and mad experimental attitudes of run-amok liberalism, with no basis in human nature and veneration to biology and sound psychiatry whatsoever. David is going to diagnose the pathology of the policies that is running this country. We'll also tie this in with a view on the Western world in general and how the Swedish system is being exported to the rest of the world, a very, very worrying trend, as we now know the result and the outcome. All right. Hi, David. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. It's great to have you here. Thank you for taking the time, coming on and talking with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
I ran across a great book review here. It was actually a few months ago back, I think it was from the Wall Street Journal, an article on Sweden specifically. We've been actually focusing a lot on the issue of Sweden and relations to other countries of the world for some time as well. But it was called "Is Sweden Raising a Generation of Brats?" And it was a review, basically, of your book, David, When the Children Took Power. And I think that this is an extremely important topic, actually, to discuss, because we've seen Nordic culture and kind of change, really, under the last, I'd say, 100 years or so, to a very, of course, very liberal political position. But I think what was interesting with the article, and of course what you go into in the book as well, is if there is a deeper kind of psychological issue that is arising due to our kind of oversensitivity when it comes to how children are raised in Sweden. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about why you wanted to write the book first, David, and what kind of got you on this track to begin with?
I started writing my first book. I'm a psychiatrist and have been working as a psychiatrist for many years. And I was the head of staff at the Stockholm Psychiatric Emergency Ward in Stockholm County. And a couple of years ago, 2006, I wrote the book In the Land of the Security Junkies, which raised the question whether we have the more safe the environment gets, the more unsecure we are feeling as adults. And when I wrote that book, it was I was thinking a lot about young generations and how come we have a situation in Sweden where people are seeking psychiatric emergency help for things that prior generations never did. So I have been thinking about these issues for many years, and my first book was a huge success in Sweden, a bestseller.
Yes.
And because of that, I've written more books in similar topics, and then that's why I have been writing three books, I decided to take a look more deeply into why children seem to be feeling, young adults, I would say, children in Sweden, they feel great, but why our young adults are feeling so bad as they actually are.
Well, Let me just ask you something about that, because that's a huge question. And actually, part of something we've addressed before with other guests on the program when it comes to the need for security and kind of comfort. I think a lot of the things that we do, David, to our that we feel is necessary to do is something that not always perhaps is the best thing to do. And of course, here where it gets kind of difficult and complicated for some people. But on a psychological basis, what kind of environment do you think that creates when we have this kind of obsession on security? Because a lot of the problems that I see happen in Sweden is kind of, you know, partially on the issue of that a lot of adults don't really get to be adults, for the lack of a better term. We have a very structured, as they would say in America, nanny state to a certain extent. It's a very, very, you know, issues of secure environment and everything else. And I've always wondered what kind of long-term effects that this actually have on people. Is there a oversensitivity here? And certainly we can tie this into the child-rearing process later, but if we focus on the adults for a minute, what kind of environment does this create? And is this something that actually works towards our detriment, despite the fact that we obviously think that security is one of the most important and aspirable aspects that we can have within society?
Yeah, the problem with security issues is that it's very difficult to not... if you're against, you can never say I'm against more security. So it always gets on a level where you tend to, the safer you get, the more safety you seek, the more security you seek. And this is, of course, in some ways, an oversensitivity creating process, because things that prior generations found uncomplicated, we are finding very complicated. And you can see this not only in Scandinavian countries, I would say. You can also see this in America. You can also see it in England and other Western countries where you have issues where, like if we go back to the children, in some states in the United States where you're not a, they have directives saying that the 12-year-old, how old should a child be to be able to stay alone in a house? And you have the kindergarten in California where I went, where the children never were allowed to be left alone. So this is not only a Swedish or Scandinavian problem. This is a Western world problem. And I think it is, in fact, because of the... that we are getting it, we have a fine society where nobody is struggling to survive. So when you quit struggling for survival, you start seeking more and more security, and you never get enough. So it's like high and low blood pressure. It's obviously very problematic to have high blood pressure, but it's also problematic to have low blood pressure, and it's the same with security. But I don't think people realize that.
Yep, very good point. Now, what are some of the problems that do you see have arisen due to this? I mean, are Swedes good at handling, let's say, conflict, for example, or conflict resolution? It seems like that there is a very kind of some of the hyper individuality that we've seen out of Sweden, which is kind of maybe a contradiction to some people, because we've had a very collectivized society. It has been socialism, democratic socialism, for many, many years in a row. It's only really in the last, 10, 15 years or so that there's been some other, political kind of different thoughts in there. But we had the concept of the folk home, folkhemmet, etc., which is kind of, I think, lies kind of at the root of the security issue. But what are some that you've seen, some of the issues that arise due to this behavior? What kind of human does this create? David,
that's a very complicated question, because it obviously you have to generalize to answer it. But in some ways you have the folk home. I also write about that in the Land of the Security Junkies. Do create some kind of persons that are not so... The interesting part is that when you have on one side, you have the person that is sort of always listening to what the state is saying, which is typical for Sweden and maybe a lot of others, some of the other Scandinavian countries. You sort of, the state is always right. So yes, if the state are doing anything to protect you, they raise more laws against bicycle helmets or legislation against what you're going to eat, etc. This is the inhabitants of Sweden would not say, "Oh, the state are they are stupid." They would say, "Oh, they are looking after our interests, my interest." And this is on one of the reasons why we don't have so much protests against this. And you said we have the Folkom and the democratic socialistic state, which we've had for 100 years. Nearly, not so long, but nearly 100 years. And the interesting thing you said, it lost 10, 15 years to have different ideas. But the reason why we have different ideas is that really the ideas are not very different. It's just that the right-wing party have turned out to become social democrats.
Oh, well, exactly. Are they right-wing anymore? I mean, it's like, you know.
Would be impossible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, are they looking after our interests, though, if we kind of look at it from that point of view a little bit? I mean, this have certainly not created a rebellious spirit. This is one that is very subjugated to authoritarianism and very compliant in that regard. And as we know from other watching other states around the world, we can know that this is, of course, a very desired kind of process of how many elites want to run government. Is this true about Sweden too, or do they have our best interest at heart?
I would say in some ways they do probably have the inhabitants' best interest at heart in hand, or what you say. but the thing is that even if they think they know, I don't think it's not. They don't want slaves, sort of brainwashed slaves. It's only a side effect of what they are doing, because everybody thinks alike, and if one. I find this bicycle helmet, which I wrote a lot about in my first book, it's not a very interest. It's a concrete way of explaining what I'm seeing in a lot of other issues. So the bicycle helmet is not that interesting per se, but it makes what happens around over time. It makes it very vivid and easy to see, because from the beginning you legislated about motorbike and the helmets in motorbikes, and then you started legislating about helmets for mopeds, and now you legislate about helmets for bicycles, and then you legislate probably helmets for pedestrians. At least we see a lot of young kids in Sweden that really have pedestrian helmets, and they have helmets when they ride on bicycles that are sort of, I don't know, 10 inches tall. Inches tall, yep. Or so. The wheels are so really small, and they still have helmets at places where there are no traffic. So this is, and I would say, those people that are doing this, that are lobbying for this kind of legislation, are not ill-meaning. They're just stupid. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I'd agree.
So I don't see it that is not. It's not that I want to enslave us. I don't think so.
All right. Right. Now, the question is, of course, where this will end, because it seems that it will not end. The children walk around with these green, you know, illuminated vests in a chain, you know, tied together. It's almost like at some point here, the security obsession becomes an inhibiting factor, and we can't really actually, you know, to kind of develop, as I said before. So how can we, as a very collectivized and yet then at the same time hyper-individualized society, where we look for authority to tell us what to do, can begin to take us out of a situation like that, do you think?
I think that the only thing that can take us out of this kind of situation is trying to inform inhabitants about. I think a lot of people, like when my book, the In the Land of Security Junkies, when it got published, it came in the right time. A lot of people had been thinking about that this is going too far, and that's why it was such a huge success. And I think it's difficult not just, you should not sit around just waiting for the next the next security issue to happen. You need to inform. You need to take up a fight against it. But on the other hand, I'm quite pessimistic because it sounds so. If you look at all surveys, etc., it's always like Sweden is such a fantastic country. It's the best, you know, in England. Exactly. Sweden is. People are happy, people are everything. But the interesting thing is that it depends on what you measure.
Of course.
And you always measure sort of things in material stuff and what people, democracy, etc., which of course is very important. But but you don't really measure anxiety level in among youngsters. You don't measure the stuff that we see in Sweden, that young people are not feeling so well as you could. So I don't understand these happiness surveys where Sweden always ends up in the top, because it's never measured with things that really do. Of course it matters, but it's not sort of the soft data, it's sort of hard data, which is fine, but the soft data in this is how people really are feeling. And the conclusion you can draw from that is that if you always measure stuff like we have a lot of, like, quite okay hospitals, quite okay schools, quite etc. So we must be happy. The thing is, what happens is that we export this folkhem. We export it to other countries, and that is what you see around the world. I would say that we set an example. So when we start, if you take the example with bicycle helmets or legislation when it comes to what kind of food you eat, and over security when it comes to health department, etc. This is we export these kind of over security, the way we over secure our world.
Well, definitely the Nordic model. We've been talking a lot about that actually, and how it is admired around the world. And absolutely, I mean, these studies always come up. Every time when you know, people wrote me in the beginning before we kind of started to cover, you know, some of these issues, and they were like, oh, Sweden, Scandinavia is so great, we admire you guys, and it's so fantastic, and you know, there's no corruption. And I was like, wait a minute, something is amiss here. You know, if you for one look at actually the groups that are behind the studies, like Ligatum Group and some of these other kind of neoconservative think tanks actually out of America, then some question marks begin to pop up. But despite all that, those aspects, it's still true that, I mean, suicide rates have been and actually are back now among an all-time high in Sweden, especially among teenagers and young men in particular. Yeah,
that's not really correct.
When
it comes to suicide rates among adults, it's fallen, the rates for the last 25 years. But it has done so in all Western world, and it has probably to do with that we are selling so much antidepressant drugs to people.
Exactly.
Whether they function or not, some of them will function on a lot of people. And maybe even if it doesn't work on everybody, because we give so much antidepressants, so it's not only against depression or anxiety. We do tend to prescribe antidepressant drugs also to normal grief, where it obviously has no effect whatsoever. But still, that has made the suicide rate fall. Suicide rate to fall. But what we see is what you say is among young people it has not fallen in the same way.
Yeah.
It has not risen though, but it's not falling.
Okay, I see.
But suicide attempts rate are rising extremely.
Sorry, say that again. What was rising?
We do have less suicide.
Yeah.
But we have much more suicide attempts.
Attempts. Okay. Yeah. Definitely. Now, well, that's interesting, though. I mean, considering that, as you said before, it's allegedly one of the world's happiest places, and yet, of course, you know, the antidepressant drug statistics should kind of put that in question marks of what actually is going on there. I think Denmark, at least, it used to be actually one of the highest, you know, kind of per capita usage of so-called happy pills. But one of the main questions was that they're more happy. Yeah.
At least in studies, they are happy.
Yeah, so I hear. I doubt some of the studies because of what we talked about before, but there you go.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
I definitely doubt them because they are measuring other things. They are not measuring the happy studies. Whether people are happy do not measure happiness. They measure things that we think will lead to happiness.
Yeah, material comfort, and
that's not happiness. That's stuff that we do think will need to happen.
Exactly, but as we know, it doesn't. It's a very kind of calculated. This comes out of, you know, social planning. Some call it social engineering, but we could see these kinds of aspects, for example, under the Million program, when these new high rises were built in Sweden, yeah. Which today are extreme eyesores, of course. But it came out of that type of environment of kind of very scientific, very calculated, okay, what does the human being need kind of thing on a material level? And then they constituted, you know, these different aspects and tried to fulfill them as much as possible. And they said, there, now you go. That's great. Now you should be happy. But the question, David, is what happens when we do not have challenges in life? I mean, if we juxtapose our way of life today a little bit with how people used to know, I mean, I don't know how much of an anthropologist you are and looking back into, you know, historical records, if you will, but it seems like it's a problem of modernity. It's a recent issue of a lot of these things that we're facing with, and the challenges that we used to have as human beings, which I believe actually made us grow and you know, in the process of achievement, you become happy, you realize you can go somewhere, you can work hard and achieve different things. But this is on a very, it's been boiled down to the very basic kind of processes of how you can live your life in Sweden. And it doesn't really extend outside of that perimeter of the playpen, if you will, that we're allowed. So what happens without challenges and conflict to a certain extent and things that we need to overcome?
That is also one of the issues of what I call security, because I have to go back once again to my first book, The Inland of Security Junkies, where I defined a syndrome which I call the national panic syndrome. I don't know if you're familiar with the term panic syndrome. Panic syndrome, mm-hmm. if you have panic syndrome, you have panic attacks. And panic attack is when your heart is beating very fast, you have difficulties breathing, you think you're going to die or become insane or something like that. And at the same time, you have agoraphobia, which makes you avoid everything. Agoraphobia is not that you're afraid of squares or so, but you're afraid, you start avoiding everything around you, and this is a psychiatric very well known syndrome, which I then applied to on the state of Sweden, and not only Sweden, I would say, because we export this, so you can see it in the Western world, the national panic syndrome, and this of course is. It's not only about the security issues that were like the bicycle helmets and safety issues, strict safety, but it also is on an emotional level that you sort of, if you have a very safe and secure surrounding, not only when it comes to real dangers and hazards, but also emotionally, you can see among the inhabitants, the people living there, in this environment, that they are do not really do not the emotional stressors become more difficult to handle for them.
Yes.
So if, and this is what you, I would say this is what you see today among young people in Sweden, and I think in other countries as well. You see young people who have never had anything difficult, any real difficulties as kids, and when they grow up, they do not know how to handle difficulties. But difficulties you will see in all countries, even in the safest countries, you will have difficulties. But if everybody's sweeping the way, the kids will never meet these difficulties. They will meet them as adults instead, and they can't handle them.
Exactly. So there's no level of kind of training process of learning to overcome issues and dealing with certain things. I mean, in regards to that, I remember a couple of years ago, I read a really good article that talked actually about the issue of the bully, for example, and how important it was, no matter how difficult it might be for parents and teachers and everything else to do this. And it's a very fine line to tread in terms of how to apply this idea. But it's very important for the individual, for the one who's being bullied, to actually, you know, overcome this on their own, right? To actually, you know, stand up to the bully or you know, kind of, you know, come to a level where they can deal with the situation on themselves. Because if they constantly have other people come in to, you know, to do conflict resolve and doing all these things, they will be, as you said, practically incapable of dealing with any of this kind of capacity when they grow up and become, you know, adults. So the question is, of course, how this, what happens here in the long term, you know, David, as well, what kind of environment we're creating for ourselves? You know, is this doing ourselves a disservice? Initially, we think that this is the good thing to do, or the right thing to do, rather.
I think this is the core question, because in the short term, this is maybe not such a great problem, because many of us that live in a society which is overprotective, oversafe, do not, even as adults, meet so many difficult situations, so we can handle it. But we live in a global world, and things happen very quickly, as I took as an example in one of my books with the Berlin Wall. If you had asked someone two months prior to the walls, when they tore it down, and asked what are the odds for the Soviet Union to collapse, people would have said, oh, that would never happen, or not in my lifetime. And 2 months later, the Soviet Union had collapsed. So what I'm saying is, as long if you do not teach people to react on that, situations may change very quickly. In the long term, we may have great problems.
What kind of problems do you think? Is it primarily psychological?
Psychological problems, but that you also see in the short term, as I mentioned. But you also see a situation where we in Sweden are extremely naive when it comes to global issues.
Yes,
we are extremely naive when it comes to our defense. We don't think we ever will be part of a war, which I hope we will not. But you never know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And when it comes to other issues where that are sort of reacting to a global world, which is not so nice, because if you like doggies, kindergarten in Sweden, we teach each other, oh, you should always be nice, and you always, that was my second book, which is really difficult to translate to English, because I wrote another book 2009, which calls something, nobody takes shit in the land of the easily offended, would be the direct translation,
right? Yeah,
which is about that the more just we are, that we are just world we live in, the more easily offended we get, and at the same time, not only because people have been easy to offend in all societies. If you go 200-300 years ago, people were really easily offended. So it's not really true to say that we are more easily offended in all ways, but what we are is that we are victims at the same time. So we don't stand up for our own rights. The only way we stand up for our own rights in Sweden is by going to an ombudsman or asking the government to help us. Yeah. We can't do it ourselves. That is also an effect, I would say, of this issue that in the long run we sort of do not try to defend ourselves, but we seek always some kind of consensus solution. Everybody should be extremely, they should have the same points of views. And we also have which I wrote about in this second book, that we have sort of a special kind of feminism in Sweden, which is not that men and women should be equal, but they should be completely alike, which is not naturally stupid to a biologist like me. I mean, yes. If you're a doctor, it's obvious for everybody that men and women are not the same. But we may, of course, we should be equal. We should thrive to be equals, and that's natural, but not the same. In Sweden, all the feminist movement is about creating identical men and women.
Exactly. It's insanity.
It's total insanity, and there's a lot of insanity in Swedish politics, I would say, that people are sort of brainwashed to do not dare. We had some people trying to say, but hey, men and women are not the same, and they are. it's very difficult to say that in a public setting in Sweden.
It is. They're being hounded like nothing else. So you've seen some tremendous targeting of people for this issue, which is of course interesting then, because you think everyone's values would be appreciated and everything. But nope, not. It's one way tolerance and political correctness is a huge part of that. But go ahead.
I call it the intolerance of the tolerant.
Exactly.
For Sweden, people should be so tolerant that they do not tolerate any other opinion than being tolerant.
Well, exactly. It's one-way tolerance, and that actually comes directly out of the book, literally, of Herbert Marcuse, one of the psychologists at the Frankfurt School, in his essay Repressive Tolerance, where he actually talked about this, and you're absolutely right. And out of that environment, things like political correctness has occurred, which stifles the debate within Sweden. I think that's the most dangerous part.
Yes, you cannot have if you have a different opinion, you're either misogynic or whatever.
Exactly.
I don't know
exactly.
The English term, but sort of anti-feminist or something. You are labeled to be a Neanderthal if you have any other view, then men and women should be exactly the same. And you have other topics and issues which is very similar to this.
Absolutely. Everyone is branded a misogynist. But I want to talk later a little bit more about the gender insanity, state feminism, kind of tie in that to the debate as well. But I wanted to ask for a moment about your view then from a biological point of view in that regard about we seem to have a pathological egalitarianist viewpoint in Sweden where progressivism, for the lack of a better term, has kind of run amok, where the basic idea here is to bring everyone onto this, make them the same, basically. And even if that entails to the lowest common denominator, which is, of course, to the detriment of all of society, because I believe we're not equal. We have different IQs, we have different capabilities, we have different talents naturally, all these things, right? But now it's kind of creating an environment where it's the classic crab mentality, right? The crabs they're trying to get out of the bucket are being pulled down by everyone else because of the fact that they don't want to, if I can't get out of here, no one is, kind of thing. And this has plagued, I think, Swedish society for such a long time, which is, of course, the Jantelagen comes kind of out of this as well. But can you speak for a moment about egalitarianism and the way that this has kind of run amok in Sweden?
Oh, you put it very well. I've written about this in all my books. The Jante law, which actually is a Danish law, it was the Axel Sandemose, from Danish-Norwegian author, that created this law that says that nobody's better than anyone else. And of course, we have had this political society where no one is allowed to be better than someone else. And that is also so that, that is not only stated in words, it's also stated in every aspect of our life. It's Sweden is the I saw statistics that show that in Sweden it's impossible, which if you live here you obviously know that it's totally impossible to become rich by working hard.
Exactly.
You yeah. know, and there's no no the proportion between your salary and whether you're wealthy or not, there's no connection whatsoever, except in the highest percentile or among the richest. There you have a small connection, but otherwise, people do not. You cannot. It's totally impossible to become rich in Sweden by working. You can become rich by inheriting money or speculate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's the only way you can become rich. And of course, what you tell the inhabitants is there's no need for you to study, because even if you study, even if you work really hard, you will not get rich anyway. And this is a way of sort of making everybody become as similar as possible.
Yeah. I mean, this is celebrating mediocrity, really, right? There's no incentive, really.
That's what I also written in my books. If you can't make the one that is less good better, you can always make the better one worse.
Oh boy, yeah. It's I can't fathom how this has come to be, and how this slowly has kind of crept into the society, I think, over a long period of time. And I struggle with it.
Excuse me. We are totally brainwashed because we don't notice ourselves.
Exactly.
That's interesting.
It's bizarre, you know, and I get very frustrated with it. And I think that people in other countries, they to a certain extent, as you said, it's a Western phenomenon overall, but this is an idea that's really been experimented on in what I like to call the political laboratory or psychological laboratory that has been Sweden, you know, and I think that to a certain extent this has been a success, and therefore it's very this is a model to be admired and to be exported to other countries. But sometimes people don't understand, you know, specifically in other parts of the world that are listeners, when I speak against this type of egalitarianism, because that's something that they're kind of striving for in their own country. But again, I don't think that they see the long term of that, David.
But I think it's also, like I mentioned, you have problems with high blood pressure. That does not contradict that you may have problems with low blood pressure. And most countries that look at Swedish model, the Scandinavian model, they have problems that are totally different from the way we have it here. But it doesn't make it good the way we have it here, because it's the opposite way around. But they cannot see that. They just say, oh wow, this is fantastic, everybody's equal. And of course, equality in sort of a theoretical version of the world is never problematic. The problematic thing is when it creates that you are not striving after being equal anymore, but being the same.
And it also kind of punctures the idea of greatness, right? To try to achieve something better, because, I mean, look at the environment we've created, David. I mean, a lot of very inventive people, creative entrepreneurs, and they like to think outside of the box. They've fled, right? They've taken off.
Yes, that's my next book, to provoke the Swedish equality syndrome. Is a book about the very few people in history that really made a difference, because
right.
there are not so many that we have to thank extremely much for everything we got today.
Exactly. Very, very. I mean, this used to be a Western kind of virtue, right? To a certain extent, of more individualistic in that degree, but it feels like we've kind of we've gone backwards in the last I don't know what 100 years or so, perhaps even more so. And it seems to be that this striving to make everyone the same again in the long term is something that's going to do us great disservice, because It is the few people that have taken the leaps, extraordinary measures to take us out of certain situations, right?
And that's very interesting because we have when you look at which I write a lot about in How Children Took Power, we have when it comes to our school system, it's down the line, it's really down the drain.
Oh yeah,
it gets worse and worse results in the PISA survey, the PISA report, which is internationally a report where you compare different countries' school system, and Sweden is falling for the last 10, 15, 20 years, and I would say probably much longer than that, but the result, it takes a while before it shows. But the interesting part is people say, oh, it must be wrong with the PISA study. Look at Daniel Ek, he invented Spotify. It's like we are really lousy in mathematics, but we are so creative in problem solving. Look at Skype.
Exactly, these are Swedish inventions, right?
But the thing is, what they do not understand is that even if we have a school system that is really lousy, some individuals may be very clever anyway, because we are not the same.
Exactly. So
do with Swedish school system on the opposite way around, I would say, because the Swedish school system are creating mediocrity.
Absolutely, I totally agree. It's
or less than mediocrity.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's get into this a little bit before we take a break here in about 5 minutes or so. But let's talk about the child rearing process. We haven't really diving into this yet because so many other things we've been talking about is so interesting and so many important points. But we can return to some of these issues maybe later in the second segment here. But tell us, if you would explain a little bit to someone from abroad, I guess, how is the typical view on child rearing in Sweden, and how did you kind of approach this topic, and when did you kind of realize that you have to like write something on this and try to contribute some sanity into the picture here, David?
the main point from parents today is I would say, are really afraid of their kids because they want to be best friends with their kids all the time. Nobody, or very few people, do want to be parents. They want to be, in this way, that's interesting because we have this sort of collective view in many ways, but on the same time, we have this individualistic approach, that sort of rock and roll approach, I will never become old. That's the worst thing you can say to Swedish parents is, how old are you? Because they want to be kids themselves. So if you want to be best friend with your kid, it's very hard to tell your best friend that now you have to eat up, or you don't have to, you're not allowed to scream in a restaurant, if you go in a shopping mall and they want to have candy, it's very difficult to say that you won't get any candy. I don't care how much you scream, you won't get candy anyway. And it's going to be difficult telling your kids that I decide where we go on vacation, or if I want to eat a chocolate bar, it doesn't mean that you are going to have a chocolate bar, etc., etc. So the approach is never being parent, and instead becoming some kind of a supervised best friend, you will give your kids some problems.
Oh yeah, no doubt. Exactly, just to say the least. I mean, yeah, we have these scenarios now where it looks like, I see some moms of teenage girls, they're going to like Lady Gaga concerts together. I mean, not that they can't, right? But it's like, you're right, it says something about that the adults are striving to be as youthful as possible, and the role model in our society is the teenager. Exactly.
Yeah, but that you have the same in America. Look at Hollywood productions. The role model is 14 years old, and a bit rebellic.
Yeah, exactly. But yet pro-establishment and pro-political correctness.
Yeah, of course.
Always that. Now, that's an interesting point, and I think that there's just so much to this. Let's talk a little bit more about this. We'll take a break here in a minute. But is there a politic kind of around, child rearing, how to bring, Swedish children up? Is this something that you've seen has been imposed from the top down, for the lack of a better term, or is this something that kind of organically and for some reason naturally has kind of arisen from the bottom up? How do you view that?
I think that's two parallel movements. You have the over liberalized way of upbringing, which is sort of like I, in some ways, explained just now before your question here, which is they can do whatever they want. But on the other hand, you have the kindergarten, the daycare, where you have very supervised work with what the kids are allowed to say and think and do. And it's very, very institutionalized. What they have a equality plan at the daycare center. You have views on tolerance, and you should teach this to 2 year olds, which I find total brainwash.
Yeah,
being total brainwash.
Well, it is. But they don't see it. The problem is that they don't see it that way.
They see it as we are so fine people. So we tell people the other stupid idiots should understand that what they should think about everything. So we tell them that.
So it's really a supremacy, superiority perspective.
Yes.
Very interesting. Let's take a short break here, David, and then we'll pick up and talk more here about in the second segment. I have so many more questions for you in terms of gender neutrality, homeschooling being banned, not to allowed to impose anything on our children, a lot more aspects we got to talk about here. But let's give out your website here and talk a little bit more about the book titles. I want you to mention the titles that you do have out there, and if they're all available in English, and what are available in Swedish, and that, so people know where to go also to pick up copies of your books.
Well, I have written 4 books. The first book, as I mentioned, Land of Security Junkies, is only available in Swedish. I had a German colleague who translated to German, but it's never published outside of Sweden. Unfortunately, because I think it's, as I said, has great bearing in countries outside of Sweden as well. And my second book, as I mentioned, in Swedish, Ingen tar skit I det lättkränktas land, which is... it's not a good English title, but but it would be, as I said, nobody takes shit in the land of the easily offended.
Yeah.
And my third book is I call it a psychiatry textbook for dummies, or psychiatry for everyone. Like I said, when it came out in Sweden, it's a psychiatry textbook for Sweden's 9.5 million psychiatrists. That is for everyone. It's called Normal, from Acts of Insanity to something, I don't know what it would be in English, but something normal. It's the title. Normal question mark.
Right. Yeah.
And then I wrote How Children Took Power last year, which is available now in Norwegian, will be available in German, in Estonia, South Korea, Brazil, and also is translated into English, but no publisher has yet published it.
Huh. Well, so, that's a shame.
Unfortunately, and we're having discussions also with Quebec and France to get a French version, and a lot of other countries are very interested, but those are the only countries that are ready. Oh, Brazil isn't really ready either, I think. But
all right, very good. What's your website, by the way? Can I pick up copies there?
It's so difficult to sell from my website, so I'm linking to like Swedish version of Amazon, but it's not called Amazon. It's Adlibris and
Adlibris.se. That's right. We'll have some of these links up here for our Swedish audience, and I do hope that your books are translated soon, into English.
English. We have an English version, but it's not published, but it's finished in English. So if you find a publisher, just can publish it from tomorrow.
All right, there we go. Well, listen to that, folks. If you're interested in that, please you know, contact David in that capacity if you're a publisher.
And if you're a publisher, you should be aware that Sweden is a country with 9 million inhabitants, and my first book, In the Land of Security Junkies in Sweden, sold 100,000 copies.
Yeah, that's very good.
And this one is selling just as much, so I think it might be a good economic idea as well.
All right, perfect. Sounds good. That's always an extra good addition to things, of course. All right, we'll take a short break here. David, please stay with us, and stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back with the second segment in a little bit.
It's just one more way of reducing your liberty and reminding you that they can fuck with you anytime they want, as long as you put up with it. As long as you put up with it. Which means, of course, anytime they want. Because that's what Americans do now. They're always willing to trade away a little of their freedom in exchange for the feeling, the illusion of security. What we have now is a completely neurotic population obsessed with security and safety and crime and drugs and cleanliness and hygiene and germs. There's another thing, germs. Where did this sudden fear of germs come from? In this country, have you noticed this? The media constantly running stories about all the latest infections, salmonella, E. coli, hantavirus, bird flu, and Americans are, they panic easily, so now everybody's running around scrubbing this and spraying that and overcooking their food and repeatedly washing their hands, trying to avoid all contact with germs. It's ridiculous, and it goes to ridiculous lengths. In prisons, before they give you a lethal injection, they swab your arm with alcohol. It's true. It's true. It's true. Well, they don't want you to get an infection. And you can see their point. Wouldn't want some guy to go to hell and be sick. It would take a lot of the sportsmanship out of the whole execution. Fear of germs. Why, these fucking pussies. You can't even get a decent hamburger anymore. They cook the shit out of everything now because everybody's afraid of food poisoning. Hey, where's your sense of adventure? Take a fucking chance, will you? You know how many people die in this country from food poisoning every year? 9,000. That's all. It's a minor risk. Take a fucking chance, bunch of goddamn pussies. Besides, what do you think you have an immune system for? It's for killing germs. But it needs practice. It needs germs to practice on. So listen. If you kill all the germs around you and live a completely sterile life, then when germs do come along, you're not going to be prepared. And never mind ordinary germs. What are you going to do when some super virus comes along that turns your vital organs into liquid shit? I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to get sick, you're going to die, and you're going to deserve it because you're fucking weak and you got a fucking weak immune system. Now, God damn it. Hey. All right. Let me tell you a true story about immunization, okay? When I was a little boy in New York City in the 1940s, we swam in the Hudson River, and it was filled with raw sewage, okay? We swam in raw sewage, you know, to cool off. And at that time, the big fear was polio. Thousands of kids died from polio every year. But you know something? In my neighborhood, no one ever got polio. No one, ever. You know why? Because we swam in raw sewage. It strengthened our immune systems. The polio never had a prayer. We were tempered in raw shit. So personally, I never take any special precautions against germs. I don't shy away from people who sneeze and cough. I don't wipe off the telephone. I don't cover the toilet seat. And if I drop food on the floor, I pick it up and eat it. I eat it. Yes, I do. Even if I'm at a sidewalk cafe in Calcutta, the poor section, on New Year's morning during a soccer riot. And you know something? In spite of all that so-called risky behavior, I never get infections. I don't get them. I don't get colds. I don't get flu. I don't get headaches. I don't get upset stomachs. And you know why? Because I got a good, strong immune system, and it gets a lot of practice. My immune system is equipped with the biological equivalent of fully automatic military assault rifles with night vision and laser scopes. and we have recently acquired phosphorus grenades, cluster bombs, and anti-personnel fragmentation mines. So, when my white blood cells are on patrol, reconnoitering my bloodstream, seeking out strangers and other undesirables, if they see any suspicious-looking germs of any kind, they don't fuck around. They whip out the weapons, they wax the motherfucker, and deposit the unlucky fellow directly into my colon. Into my colon. There's no nonsense. There's no Miranda warning. There's none of that three strikes and you're out shit. First defense, bam, into the colon you go. And speaking of my colon, I want you to know I don't automatically wash my hands every time I go to the bathroom, okay? Can you deal with that? Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. You know when I wash my hands? When I shit on them. That's the only time. That's the only... And you know how often that happens? Tops, 2-3 times a week. Tops. Maybe a little more frequently over the holidays, you know what I mean? And I'll tell you something else, my well-scrubbed friends. You don't always need a shower every day. Did you know that? It's overkill. Unless you work out or work outdoors or for some reason come in intimate contact with huge amounts of filth and garbage every day, you don't always need a shower. All you really need to do is to wash the four key areas. Armpits, asshole, crotch, and teeth. Got that? Armpits, asshole, crotch, and teeth. In fact, you can save yourself a whole lot of time if you simply use the same brush on all four areas.